This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
As you probably know, Lyme disease is the most common tick-borne infection in the United States. The history of the discovery of Lyme disease is actually very, very interesting. It deals with kind of concerned parents. There's a little bit of an international flavor to it. And the discovery of the disease is just a wonderful example of modern medical mystery and medical problem solving. To kind of add to the intrigue of this disease, I don't know whether you know this or not, but you will become aware of it as I go through the evening. Lyme disease is, in the last 15 years, has become actually the most controversial and most politicized disease in all of medicine. And what I am going to do this evening, before I go any farther, I just want to tell you that I have no disclosures. But what I'm going to do this evening is to talk about the history of Lyme disease. I'll tell you how this new disease was discovered. I will tell you how the cause or the etiology of the disease was discovered. And then I'm going to fall into kind of the routine lecture for an infectious disease topic, in the sense that I'm going to talk about clinical manifestations, diagnosis, therapy, and prevention. And then at the end, I'm going to share with you the controversies that surround this disease. And the controversies are really very, very dramatic. And I realize that since this is a controversial topic, that perhaps not everyone in the audience shares my views about this disease. I will try to be as balanced as possible about what this disease is. And at the end, we can discuss people's opinions about the controversies. Let me start with a definition of what Lyme disease is. And the best definition is that Lyme disease is a bacterial infection caused by the spirochete Borrelia burgdorferi in the U.S. and Borrelia afzelii and Borrelia guarinii in Europe and Asia, and is transmitted to humans by the bite of an infected Ixodes complex deer tick. The clinical manifestations can be complex, but they affect primarily the skin, the joints, the nervous system, and the heart. Now, if I were sitting out in the audience, my response to that definition would be something like this. What in the world is he talking about? I don't have a clue of what he's talking about. Bacteria, spirochetes, ticks, what is all this stuff? Let me explain it to you. In infectious diseases, well, Lyme disease is a bacterial infection, and I will tell you that in infectious diseases, we deal with a number of different types of organisms. The most common types of organisms that we deal with are bacteria and viruses. So bacteria are single-celled organisms that divide by fission. They can exist anywhere. They exist on us. They exist in us. They exist in the environment. They can exist on inanimate objects. They exist in animals and insects. They're every place. And bacteria respond to antibiotic therapy, unlike viruses that do not respond to antibiotic therapy. The other large category of organisms that we deal with is viruses. These are much smaller organisms. They do not have an independent energy source, and therefore, that when they infect someone or some animal, they live within the host cell and use the energy produced by the host cell in order to replicate. And as I said, viruses do not respond to antibiotics, and depending upon what the virus is, they may respond to an antiviral agent. So Lyme disease is caused by a bacteria, and it's caused by spirochete Borrelia burgdorferi in the United States and afzelii and guarinii in Europe and Asia. What is a spirochete? When we talk about bacteria, in infectious diseases. We divide them into several different groups. The most common types of bacteria that we deal with are gram-positive organisms and gram-negative organisms. And I hesitate to tell you this because it's so simplistic and you'll think infectious disease is so simple, but it actually is pretty easy to understand this. When a specimen comes down to the microbiology laboratory, the first thing that's done is a stain on the specimen. And this is called a gram stain. And it takes about 3 minutes to do it. You look under the microscope, and we divide organisms, for the most part, into two large categories. If they stain purple like this, they are referred to as being gram positive. And I, being a kind of an alliteration kind of person, I always remember that. Purple is positive. And most of the time, the gram-positive organisms are round, and they're referred to as gram-positive cocci. And the example that you're probably familiar with would be Staph aureus, or methicillin-resistant Staph aureus is a good example of a gram-positive organism. The other huge group of organisms that we deal with stain red and are referred to as gram-negative organisms. Instead of being round, they are kind of elongated and are rod-shaped, and they're referred to as gram-negative rods. And an example of that would be E. coli. So most of the organisms that we deal with fall into these two categories. There are less common organisms that we deal with, less common bacteria that we deal with. One of those is acid-fast bacteria. This requires a special stain. You can see the acid-fast organism is red. And the best example of an acid-fast organism is tuberculosis. Now, the least common organism or bacteria that we deal with in infectious diseases is a spirochete. And you can see this corkscrew nature of the spirochete. And the two most common spirochetal infections that we deal with are Lyme disease and syphilis. So getting back to the definition, we're talking about a bacteria that is a spirochete, and it is transmitted to humans by the Ixodes ricinus complex of deer tick. So let's do a little tick biology 101. And I will tell you that for our purposes, you just need to know that there are two types of ticks. There are hard-shell ticks and there are soft-shell ticks. And we're dealing with hard-shell ticks. And the Ixodes ricinus complex is a hard-shelled tick. And there are different species of these Ixodes ticks depending upon the geographic area that you live in. So that if you live in the northeastern United States or the upper Midwest, the Ixodes tick that we're concerned about for Lyme disease is referred to as Ixodes scapularis or Ixodes damini. On the West Coast, the tick is Ixodes pacificus, and in Europe, this hard tick is referred to as Ixodes ricinus. The other thing you need to know about ticks is that there are three separate stages for ticks as they go through their developmental stage. The youngest form of the tick is a larval form. That metamorphs into a nymphal form, and then there is the adult form. The nymphal form of the Ixodes tick is the one that most commonly transmits the organism of Lyme disease to humans. This form of the tick feeds usually in the spring and summer, May through July or August, and it feeds on the white-footed mouse, and it also feeds on humans as well if humans are out in their environment. The adult can also transmit the organism responsible for Lyme disease, but much less commonly. And the adult feeds on larger mammals, especially the deer, and on humans as well. And this is where it gets its name of the deer tick. And this is what the Ixodes ticks that transmit Lyme disease look like. So this is the nymphal form of the disease of the deer tick. doesn't really transmit very much to humans. This is the nymph, which is the primary culprit. This is the adult male and the adult female. The adult male does not transmit Lyme disease to humans, but the adult female does transmit Lyme disease. Now, just to give you a hint of what we're dealing with and what the size is, this is obviously a dime. This is the larval, the nymph, the male, and the female. And the size of these things have been likened to a sesame seed. So this is about the size of a sesame seed. This is the nymphal form, and this is the adult female. Now, just to give you a feel in real life what this looks like, I will tell you that I have a sample of a nymphal tick that I will pass around. But before I do that, I want to tell you that this was given to me by my boss, Joanne Engel, who is the chief of infectious diseases at UCSF, gave this to me. And she told me that she has had this for 20 years. And it's pretty clear she's quite fond of this little tick. So I want to make sure that I get it back. But please, let me pass it around, and you'll be able to see that. Just to give you a feel for how small this tick really is. Don't lose it. I don't want to lose my emeritus status over something the size of a sesame seed. So, now, these are blood-sucking insects, or arthropods, and therefore, after a blood meal, they are much, much bigger when they have had a blood meal than the unengorged tick. So we've talked about this, bacterial infection, spirochete, transmitted by the Ixodes tick, different species in different parts of the country. And the clinical manifestations usually infect the skin, the joints, the nervous system, and the heart. The first description of Lyme disease was in 1909 by a little-known Swedish dermatologist, Arvid Afzelius. Now, I've just told you that one of the species of Borrelia that transmits disease in Europe is Borrelia afzelii. And in fact, it was named after this particular dermatologist. But in 1909, this dermatologist presented a paper in Stockholm describing a patient with an expanding circular red rash that lasted several weeks following the bite of a sheep tick. The name that was given to this rash was erythema, which is just a fancy way of saying red, chronicum, because it lasted for several weeks and was chronic, and migrans, because it expanded. So it was erythema, chronicum, migrans of Afzelius, or erythema, chronicum, migrans. And this is what the rash looks like. This is a typical red expanding rash. The original tick bite looks like it may have been here. And about 7 or 10 days after the tick bite, the rash develops and begins to expand. Quite characteristic of this rash is the fact that there is some central clearing as it resolves. And this is a typical bullseye or target lesion rash that is very commonly seen in Lyme disease. And it's seen, as I'll tell you a little bit later, in about 70 to 80% of patients who have Lyme disease. Skipping forward to the modern day history of Lyme disease, the story begins in Old Lyme, Lyme, in East Haddam, Connecticut. And what happened was that in November of 1975, a mother from Old Lyme, Connecticut, informed the Connecticut State Health Department that 12 children from a very small community had been diagnosed with a very rare form of arthritis called juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. Now, I want to impress upon you that this is a very, very rare disease. Although I don't see lots of kids, in my 30-plus years of doing infectious diseases, I've seen a handful of people with juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. And here, there were 12 kids in a very short period of time who were diagnosed with this disease. So something was kind of amiss about that. And during the same month, another mother from the same community presented to the rheumatology clinic at Yale and also described a group of kids who had this arthritis in this small community. This is actually the concerned mother, Polly Murray, who first reported those 12 cases of arthritis. She was the one who described what would be known as Lyme disease in the future. This is her at a later stage of her life, not when she reported the disease. And this is actually from the cover of her book that she subsequently wrote called The Widening Circle, A Lyme Disease Pioneer Tells Her Story. So in response to this report to the state health department and the presentation to Yale Rheumatology Clinic, they decided to investigate this outbreak of arthritis. And the two people who were sent to investigate the outbreak were Dr. Alan Steer, viewed here in his present-day form. At the time, he was in training at Yale in rheumatology and worked at Yale learning the trade of rheumatology. They also sent Dr. David Snydman from the Connecticut State Health Department to go investigate this outbreak of arthritis that they had seen, that had been reported. And 2 years after this report in 1975, in 1977, they wrote an article along with some other people about Lyme arthritis and the epidemic that was going on in Old Lyme, Lyme, and East Haddam, Connecticut. And what they described was the following, that there were a total of 51 residents, which turned out to be, believe it or not, 1% of the entire population who had arthritis. The arthritis was of very sudden onset. It involved kind of large weight-bearing joints, knees more commonly than ankles. And it lasted several weeks and then resolved spontaneously. Because the cause was not known and there was no therapy for it, it turned out that 70% of these patients with arthritis at some time in the future actually had another bout of arthritis. So it was a recurrent disease. And this is pretty much what these kids look like. And I think you can appreciate that this is a normal knee, and this is enlarged and swollen, and there's fluid on the knee. This is an ankle that you can appreciate is swollen and had some redness to it. So this is the kind of arthritis that these kids had, and some of the adults as well. It's a little bit different than what we see with, like, for instance, the Staph aureus arthritis, the septic arthritis. Those patients are in severe pain and have very high fevers and would never be like these patients where they're standing on their leg. When you have a Staph aureus septic arthritis, it's very, very painful. They can't bear any weight, and they won't even let you bend their knee at all. So this is a little bit milder form of arthritis, not quite like the acute bacterial arthritis that people were seeing in other settings. Other important observations that were made in this paper were that a significant number of the patients recalled a red expanding rash several weeks before the onset of their arthritis, and one individual actually remembered a tick bite preceding this expanding rash. Most of the infected individuals lived in heavily wooded areas or on farms. They did not live in the city center of Lyme, Old Lyme, or East Haddam. And most of the cases of arthritis occurred in the summer months. So based on these observations, it is absolutely incredible to me how right on Dr. Steer was in his conclusions to this paper in 1987, because he described to a T what would subsequently become known about Lyme arthritis. And what he said was, in this paper, was that the clustering of cases together suggested an infectious etiology, that there was some infection that was causing this. And at the time, the etiology was not known. The clustering of cases in wooded areas and the peak occurrence in the summer months, and this is a direct quote from his paper, led the authors to believe that the epidemiology fits best with an illness transmitted by an arthropod vector or a tick. And finally, because of the description of some of the patients with this red rash that was associated with their arthritis, he noted the similarity of this rash to the erythema chronica migrans of Afzelius that was postulated to be and he postulated that it was transmitted by an Ixodes ricinus tick. So he was right on in his observations at the time. Now I'm going to switch gears just a little bit and tell you the incredible story, I think incredible story, of how the etiology of this disease, how Borrelia was discovered to be the cause of this disease. And the players are very different. The key player here is Dr. Willy Burgdorfer. And as you know, I already said that the organism that causes Lyme disease in the United States is Borrelia burgdorferi. So it was named after this gentleman. And he had a job at the Rocky Mountain Laboratory in Hamilton, Montana. A colleague of his, Alan Barber, worked also at that lab, and he was responsible for developing the culture media that allowed them to grow the Borrelia in the laboratory. And the final key player in this is Jorge Benach, who I think is still a microbiologist at State University in New York at Stony Brook. But at the time, he worked for the New York State Health Department. So these are the key players. And I will share with you that when you read through and Dr. Burgdorfer's description of how this all came about, and actually from now on I'm probably going to refer to him as Willie. I think he refers to himself as Willie. And furthermore, it's a mouthful to keep saying Dr. Burgdorfer every time. So when you read his description of how all this came about, he raises the question of how this discovery should be viewed. Should it be viewed as a scientific breakthrough? Was it serendipity? Was it blind luck and an accident? Or was it the result of 35 years of research into the complex relationship of ticks, the bacteria that they have in them, and their relationship with humans? So I'll tell you the story, and I'll let you to decide which one of these applies. So the story with Willie starts back in 1946 when he was accepted as a graduate student at the University of Basel. His mentor was interested in blood-sucking ticks. It was his life. And he gave Willie his PhD project, which was to study a Borrelia species that caused disease in sheep and was transmitted by ticks. And as Willie describes it, for the next 3 years, I dissected thousands of ticks and studied the replication of bacteria in the tick. Now, you see how small that tick is. And to think about dissecting thousands of ticks, I can't imagine anything more tedious. But one of the amazing discoveries that he made was that, in fact, you didn't have to dissect the entire midgut or stomach of the tick to figure out what they had ingested or what kind of bacteria they had ingested. But because after they ingested bacteria, kind of disseminated throughout the tick, all you had to do was cut off the legs of the tick, squeeze out some fluid, which he called endolymph, and by looking at the endolymph and the bacteria that were in the endolymph, you could figure out pretty much what the tick had ingested. So it saved a huge amount of time doing that. The next key thing that happened to Willie was that in 1949, he went to a meeting in Cincinnati, Ohio. Now, when I read this, I took great pause. If you think about air travel in 1950, it was hardly sophisticated. And to get from Basel to Cincinnati, Ohio, must have been a real feat in order to do that. And I'm sitting there asking myself, why did he do that? Was it because it was the end of his PhD and he said, I deserve this? Did he have friends in the United States? Was this a boondoggle? Or was this just the best TIC meeting ever? And he had to go to this TIC meeting in Cincinnati, Ohio. Nonetheless, he gets to Cincinnati, and in 1949, at this meeting, he hears a paper presented on the erythema chronica migrans of Afzelius. And in the 40 years that had elapsed since the original description in 1909 and to 1949, when he goes and hears this paper, a number of things had been learned. First of all, it appeared that this rash seemed to respond to antibiotics, suggesting that the rash was caused by a bacteria. There was a claim that was made, although there is very little evidence for it, that the culprit that caused the rash was transmitted by an Ixodes ricinus tick and was caused by a spirochete or Borrelia species. And when Willie heard this, he thought that this was ludicrous, that it made no sense at all, because the dogma at the time was that only soft ticks, not hard ticks like Ixodes ricinus, harbored Borrelia species. So he totally dismissed this, being an expert in ticks and an expert in Borrelia. And he said that this is nonsense. It couldn't possibly be true that a hard tick harbored Borrelia species. So he then, the next thing that happens is that after he finishes his PhD, he gets a job at the Rocky Mountain Laboratory in Hamilton, Montana. And he describes his mentor, Dr. Gordon Davis, as the world's best-known Borreliologist. And you can just tell when you read Willie's account of all of this that if you read between the lines, you can just tell that he has in his heart that someday he wants to displace Dr. Davis as the world's best-known Borreliologist. But as fate would have it, funding for Borrelia research dried up, and he couldn't do any more research, and his dreams of becoming a world-famous Borreliologist went up in smoke. But like all good scientists, he started to go where the money was, and he started studying another tick-borne disease, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, which was transmitted by a soft tick. And it was about this time, in 1975, that he began a collaboration with Dr. Banach of the New York State Health Department. There had been a couple of cases of Rocky Mountain spotted fever on Long Island, and he asked Dr. Banach to send him soft ticks from the area so that he could look at them and see if he could find out the cause of Rocky Mountain spotted fever. Now, I want you to remember that in 1977, Dr. Steer published his paper on Lyme arthritis. And as Willie tells the story, that after that paper was published, Dr. Steer actually called Willie and said, you know, I have this disease. I think it's transmitted by a tick. Tell me about ticks. And apparently they had two multi-hour conversations about tick biology, transmission of infections by tick, et cetera. And nothing more came of that at the time. The next thing that happened was that in 1981, after examining hundreds, if not thousands, of dog ticks, looking for the cause of Rocky Mountain spotted fever and finding nothing, Willie said to himself, you know, maybe I'm looking at the wrong kind of tick. And so he calls Dr. Banach and he says, you know, instead of sending me soft ticks, send me some hard ticks. I want to look at some hard ticks. So he goes out to Shelter Island, Dr. Banach does, and he gets a whole bunch of Ixodes damini ticks. Now, Shelter Island not only had a few cases of Rocky Mountain spotted fever, but it had tons of cases of Lyme disease. So he gets these hard ticks, and he starts looking at the hard ticks. And what he sees is, in the endolymph, some kind of weird parasite that he's never seen before. And he says, you know, I better take the time to dissect these teeny tiny ticks and really take a look at their stomach and find out what's going on, since there's such a weird finding in the endolymph. And he dissects the midgut of the ticks, and he doesn't find a parasite, but what he finds is this. He finds tons and tons of spirochetes of Borrelia species in the midgut of these Ixodes damini ticks. And all of a sudden, the light bulb goes on. And he says to himself, you know, in 1949, I heard a lecture about erythema chronica migrans, and they said that Ixodes ticks carried a spirochete that was the cause of this disease. And I remember in 1977 having a discussion with Dr. Steer about Lyme disease and about Ixodes damini ticks. And he said, you know, I think I just found the cause of erythema chronica migrans, and I think I just discovered the cause of Lyme disease. And sure enough, what he did was he went and he dissected 124 more of these Ixodes damini ticks that Dr. Banach had sent. And in 60% of them, he found those spirochetes. He then called some colleagues in Europe where Ixodes ricinus tick is, and he found the spirochetes in them. And then he called Dr. Robert Lane, who's at UC Berkeley, and got some Ixodes pacificus ticks out here, and he found the spirochete in them as well. And in 1983, Dr. Steer and Dr. Barber and Dr. Bergdorfer, among others, wrote a paper about the spirochetal etiology of Lyme disease to nail down that it was, in fact, a spirochete that caused this disease. And what they did was they were able to take patients with chronic Lyme disease, and they would aspirate the joint fluid, and with the culture medium of Dr. Barber, they were able to culture spirochetes out of the joint fluid. They were able to take these spirochetes that he could see under the microscope and actually culture those spirochetes on the culture medium. And he was able to demonstrate that patients who had late Lyme disease had produced antibodies to these spirochetes that he was able to isolate. So let me just take a minute to explain antibody titers to you, just to make sure that you understand this. So when we are faced with a new pathogen that comes into us, like, you know, if we get measles, mumps, or rubella, or something like that, the natural response of the body is to develop antibody titers to those organisms. And the body produces two types of antibodies. One is an IgM antibody. This occurs, it starts to rise in a couple of weeks to a month after exposure. It peaks in several months, and then it disappears totally. A later response is an IgG antibody. It develops a month or 6 weeks after exposure to the organism. It rises, and it actually stays positive for the lifetime of the individual and actually protects against reinfection with that particular organism. So what they were able to show in this early study was that 94% of the patients with late manifestations of Lyme disease had antibody titers to Borrelia species that had been isolated. And this is how the disease, the etiology of the disease was discovered. And as I said, the Borrelia species is named after Dr. Bergdorfer, and it's Borrelia bergdorferi. I think his lifelong dream of becoming the world's most famous Borreliologist was realized with that discovery. And I will let you decide how to view this. My personal feeling is, yes, it was a scientific breakthrough, perhaps a little bit serendipity, but I think it was the result of studying ticks for 35 years and being able to fit the pieces of the puzzle together. I'm now going to turn to the clinical manifestations of Lyme disease. And what I'm going to tell you about clinical manifestations, diagnosis, and therapy of Lyme disease is what I am calling kind of the classic description of Lyme disease. And by that, I mean if you were to pick up a textbook of internal medicine or family practice or infectious diseases, this is what you would read about the clinical manifestations, the diagnosis, and the therapy. And this is where the controversy of Lyme disease arises. And I will get to the controversy in a few minutes. So the classic description of Lyme disease is that there are different stages of the disease. In the early stages of the disease, the early localized infection, which occurs 7 to 10 days after the tick bite, you see the characteristic rash that we've been talking about that I showed you, erythema migrans, and that's seen in about 70 to 80% of patients. The other very common manifestation in early Lyme disease is that patients get kind of a flu-like illness. They get fatigue, headaches, fevers, muscle aches and pains. It's a flu-like symptom. You just feel lousy, but they don't have the runny nose or the cough or the watery eyes or anything like that. And remember, the nymphal form of the tick bites in the summer. So this is referred to in endemic areas as the summer flu. So early manifestations of Lyme disease present either as erythema migrans or as the summer flu. If left untreated, several weeks to months later, additional manifestations can occur. The most common manifestation are neurologic manifestations. The most common manifestation is meningitis, where patients will get headache, they'll get a stiff neck, the light will bother their eyes. Or the other very common manifestation is a facial palsy, a facial droop that occur if the early manifestations are not treated. Much less commonly, the heart can be affected and you get heart block. And what that means is that patients, their conduction system doesn't work, and they can get lightheaded, dizzy, and some of them even pass out when they have involvement of the heart. But not very common. And then months to years later, late manifestations can occur in untreated patients. And I want to emphasize this is untreated patients. In treated patients, almost none of this ever occurs. And the most common late manifestation is the arthritis that we talked about that was investigated by Dr. Steer back in 1975. And the other manifestation that can occur late is neurologic manifestations. And the neurologic manifestations can take a couple of forms. It can affect the peripheral nervous system, where you can get numbness, tingling, and pain in your hands or your feet. Or it can affect the central nervous system. The central nervous system, you can get some cognitive disturbances, and you can get sometimes some very, very serious neurologic symptoms from late Lyme disease. But I will tell you that the neurologic manifestations of Lyme disease in the United States are not very common at all, as opposed to Europe, where these manifestations, particularly the encephalopathy in this serious form of involvement of the central nervous system, is much, much more common. And the reason for that is that the Borrelia guarinii, which is one of the causes of Lyme disease in Europe, has a particular predilection for nervous tissue, and it tends to affect the peripheral nerves and the central nervous system very commonly, whereas Borrelia burgdorferi does not have that predilection for the nervous system, and therefore we hardly ever see nervous system manifestations in the United States. It's pretty uncommon to see these things. The diagnosis of this disease is made depending in different ways depending upon the stage of the disease. So in early disease, when patients have the rash or the summer flu, the diagnosis is a clinical diagnosis. You can't take blood and do a test to see if they've developed antibody titers. The reason being that it takes the antibodies 3 weeks, 4 weeks, sometimes 5 or 6 weeks to develop, whereas the clinical manifestations develop after 10 to 14 days, or 7 to 14 days. So if you were to test somebody with erythema migrans for antibodies, their antibody titer is likely to be negative. So early in the course of the disease, the diagnosis is made clinically. For the later manifestations of the disease, for the arthritis, for the heart disease, the recommendation by the Center for Disease Control is a two-stage serologic testing. There is a screening test, which is an ELISA test, which is very, very sensitive. That is to say that it picks up not only Lyme disease, but it picks up a bunch of other things as well. So the way this is carried out is that you screen with an ELISA, and if the test is negative, no further testing is needed because it's such a sensitive test. If the test is positive, you have to do a confirmatory test to make sure that it's positive because of a Borrelia infection and not something else. And the confirmatory test that is done is the Western blot test. Now, remember, I told you in the paper in 1993, with a very crude assay looking at antibodies to Borrelia burgdorferi, that 94% of patients with late manifestations of Lyme disease had positive antibodies to the organism, which is pretty much what you'd expect. With some refinement of the test, today, the sensitivity of the two-tier testing is close to 100%. And the dogma is that all patients with objective neurologic, cardiac, or joint abnormalities associated with Lyme disease have positive serologic tests for Borrelia burgdorferi, for antibodies to Borrelia burgdorferi. So it's very sensitive and very specific. Now, all of that I've told you about the clinical manifestations and the diagnosis and what I'm going to tell you about the therapy are very controversial. We'll get there in a minute. I just want to point out some clues that I use when I see patients to making the diagnosis of Lyme disease. First of all, the question always comes up. You get a tick bite, and within a couple of days, you see a red area around the tick bite. This is not erythema migrans. This is a reaction to the tick bite itself, to the chemicals in the tick and the tick bite. Erythema migrans takes 7 to 10 days to develop, and these early red reactions that you see are reactions to the tick, not a manifestation of Lyme disease. The other very important thing is that ticks have to feed for 24 to 36 hours to transmit the Borrelia from the tick to the human. So if you're out in the woods and you do a tick check at the end of the day and you see a tick and you take it off, the likelihood that you will ever develop Lyme disease is close to zero because the tick is not fed long enough. So very helpful in making the diagnosis of Lyme disease. And then it's very important to know the prevalence of ticks that carry Borrelia in the area that you live. So if you were to look at ticks on the East Coast, the Ixodes scapularis or Ixodes damini, 60 to 70% of those ticks are actually infected with Borrelia. And therefore, a tick bite in those areas of the country are likely to result in Lyme disease. In contrast, on the West Coast, in California, Oregon, Washington, about 5% of infected ticks have Borrelia in them. And therefore, the likelihood of developing Lyme disease after a tick bite out here, is quite remote. And I just wanted to show you this Herculean effort that the California State Health Department has done and is on their website. This is absolutely incredible. Over a period of years, they have collected Ixodes pacificus ticks, and they have done tests to see whether those ticks actually have Borrelia in them. And this is on their website, and obviously it's a map of California, and every single county is represented on here. So you can click on a county, which I've done. I've clicked on Sonoma County, and what you see when you click on that county is that they have, over the years, looked at close to 5,600 Ixodes ticks. And when they looked at adult ticks, it turned out that only 1% of them had Borrelia in them and were capable of transmitting the disease. And of the nymphal ticks, 2.6% had Borrelia in them and were capable of transmitting the disease. So very, very helpful information for clinicians about the risk that you might get Lyme disease from a tick bite in any given area. And it also emphasizes the point that ticks out on the West Coast are not very likely to carry Borrelia burgdorferi. Over the years, a number of antibiotics have been shown to be effective against Borrelia. I don't think for our purposes it's worthwhile to go through the details of this, but a number of antibiotics work, both intravenous and oral antibiotics. But more importantly, what I want to point out to you is that in the textbooks that of medicine or infectious diseases or the guidelines from the Infectious Disease Society of America for the therapy of Lyme disease, what is recommended is, regardless of the stage of the disease, the maximum amount of therapy is 4 weeks of therapy with any of these antibiotics. And it doesn't matter whether it's the early localized form, whether it's late Lyme disease with arthritis, whether it's meningitis involvement of the central nervous system, the longest that they recommend treatment is 28 days of therapy. Just a word about prevention of Lyme disease before I jump into the controversies of this disease. The recommendation is to wear light-colored protective clothing so you can see the little black legs of these ticks. Shirt should be tucked into the pants tucked into socks. DEET is very effective when applied to the skin. Permethrin sprays for the clothes is very effective. And as I've indicated, probably the best thing you can do when you're out in the woods is to do a careful tick check when you get back, because the tick has to feed for so long to transmit the disease. Everybody wants to know how you remove a tick once you have one. You don't need matches, you don't need hot oil, you don't need butter, you don't need any of that stuff. All you need is the tweezers. You get as close to the skin as you possibly can, and you lift directly up, and almost always the tick will disembed and come up out of the skin. The other thing I wanted to point out to you is that at one point in time, there actually was a very effective vaccine available on the market for preventing Lyme disease. This was approved by the FDA in 1998, and it was a three-dose vaccine, and it was 78% effective in preventing Lyme disease. It was on the market for 4 years, and in 2002, GlaxoSmithKline took it off the market for a number of reasons. This whole story of the Lyme vaccine is just a story in itself of mismanaging how to handle a good product on the market. But basically, GlaxoSmithKline took it off the market because they were concerned about potential lawsuits from adverse effects from the Lyme vaccine. And because they were going to have to pay for the cost of the lawsuits, they decided that it just wasn't worth it, the demand wasn't high enough, and they took it off the market. We can talk about that in the question and answer if you're interested in it, but as it stands today, you can get a Lyme vaccine for your dog, but you can't get one for yourself. Let's move on to the controversies in Lyme disease. And the controversies stem from the recommendations of the Infectious Disease Society of America, the IDSA, and the guidelines that they published on clinical manifestations, diagnosis, and therapy. And basically, what I've told you about those aspects of the disease are things that you can find in the official guidelines from the Infectious Disease Society of America. There is a whole alternative view of what Lyme disease is. And this alternative view of Lyme disease is held by Lyme-literate physicians. And this is not a derogatory term. They actually like being referred to as Lyme-literate physicians because it implies that they know more about Lyme disease than most people do. Most of the Lyme-literate physicians are members of the International Lyme and Associated Disease Society in the United States. And in 2004, they published their own guidelines of clinical manifestations, diagnosis, and therapy. And I'm going to share with you what those recommendations are in a moment. I will also tell you that the Lyme-literate physicians and this ILADS, International Lyme and Associated Disease Society, is supported by incredibly powerful patient advocacy groups. So how far apart are the conventional views about Lyme disease that I've told you about and the views of the Lyme-literate physician and ILADS? As far as the clinical manifestations go, I told you that the conventional teaching is skin, joints, neurologic system, heart. In contrast, the Lyme-literate physicians say, no, that's not true at all. There are a whole host of symptoms that can be a manifestation of Lyme disease. You can have fatigue. You can have night sweats, sore throat. You can have swollen glands, a stiff neck. You can have diarrhea, abdominal pain. You can have depression. You can have back pain. You can have jaw pain. You can have ringing in your ears. You can have headaches. All of those are manifestations of Lyme disease. Furthermore, the diagnosis is very different. As I've told you, the IDSA recommends two-tier testing, the ELISA followed by a confirmatory test, and it's felt that it's almost 100% sensitive in picking up patients with late stages of Lyme disease. The ILADS physician and the Lyme-literate physician say, no, 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 that's not the case at all. That the diagnosis of Lyme disease by the two-tier stage fails to detect 90% of the cases. Furthermore, since there is no definitive test that can be done, the diagnosis of Lyme disease, any stage of Lyme disease, early or late Lyme disease, is a clinical diagnosis. So how does this work out in reality? This is how it works out in reality. I go in to a Lyme-literate physician, and I say, you know, I'm not feeling well. I have headaches. I have a stiff neck. I have a backache. My muscles ache, and I am incredibly fatigued. And the Lyme-literate physician says, oh, you have Lyme disease. And I'm ecstatic. There's something that explains my symptoms. And I said, great. I mean, my response, I'm sure, would be yours. Let's do a test to find out whether I have Lyme disease or not. And the answer is, well, the tests aren't very good. So there's no confirmatory test that I can do. So my next question, as I'm sure your next question would be, well, how do you know I have Lyme disease? And the answer is, you have Lyme disease because I said you have Lyme disease. And that's the way it plays out. That's pretty much the way it plays out if you adhere to this diagnosis. And as far as the therapy goes, I told you that the longest therapy that the IDSA recommends is 28 days of antibiotics. The Lyme-literate physicians and members of ILADS say no, no, no. That these symptoms of fatigue and muscle aches and pains and headaches and not being able to remember where you put your keys down. These things can be chronic. You can have chronic Lyme disease that can last for a long period of time. And you can't just prescribe to a 30-day treatment that one size fits all. You have to treat patients until their symptoms go away. And how that translates is, and we see these patients in our clinic not infrequently, is that they will be put on antibiotics for months to years of antibiotics, sometimes intravenously. We've seen patients walk in with a line in their arm that have been on antibiotics for 12 months because their symptoms haven't gotten better yet. And sometimes they'll even use combinations of antibiotics to treat themselves, to treat these patients. So how contentious is this difference of the view of Lyme disease? Well, it's very contentious. The academicians write papers like this: the anti-science and ethical concerns associated with advocacy of Lyme disease. This was published in a very prestigious infectious disease journal just a couple of years ago. And what the academicians say is that these Lyme-literate physicians are anti-science and pseudoscientific practitioners. They use unvalidated laboratory tests to make the diagnosis. They refer to the fact that certain specialty laboratories, particularly ones in California and Kansas, have been investigated and fined because of the diagnostic tests that they do for Lyme disease. And I will tell you that, you know, in our neck of the woods, the laboratory down on the peninsula that's a specialty laboratory that all the Lyme-literate physicians in this area send their labs to is Igenex Laboratory. And because of the lawsuit that was filed many years ago now, and this has all been resolved, when I see a patient with laboratory results from Igenex, the way the results are reported is CDC interpretation negative, Igenex interpretation positive. And that's how they get around the way they do their laboratory tests. They also list in this article the fact that current and former ILADS officers have been sanctioned by the state medical boards or have been reprimanded by federal agencies. And they cite one university professor who was the president of ILADS, who was dismissed from the university for falsifying laboratory data that was published in a peer-reviewed article and was asked to leave the university that he worked at. And this is public knowledge, they're pretty vicious about this. And these are the academicians. But I will tell you that the Lyme-literate physicians don't take this sitting down. There was a worldwide Lyme rally and protest in New York City just in May of this year. And this was the comments of Dr. Legner, who was one of the Lyme-literate physicians. And he was talking about chronic Lyme disease. And he said, chronic Lyme disease does not exist. There are at least four possibilities to explain why a person might hold this view. They can be dumb as bags of rocks. They can be character disordered with exceeding rigid thinking, impenetrable circular logic. They can be corrupt. They can be sociopaths. One thing is for damn sure. They are truly lousy clinicians. So this is the kind of repartee that goes on between the conventional view of Lyme disease and this alternative view of Lyme disease. How contentious is it? The recommendations by the Infectious Disease Society of America was published in 2006, and they're basically the recommendations that I talked to you about. Shortly after they were published, the Attorney General of Connecticut, and now the Senator from Connecticut, Richard Blumenthal, sued the Infectious Disease Society of America over the guidelines that they had published. And he said that they severely constrict the choices and legitimate diagnosis and treatment options of the patients. And basically what he's saying here is that the Infectious Disease Society of America recommends 4 weeks of therapy. Lyme-literate physicians recommend a years of therapy or months of therapy. And basically, insurance companies are not going to pay for years of antibiotic therapy. And they cite the infectious disease recommendations in order to justify the fact that they're not going to treat for years. And in addition, he accused that the panelists on the recommendations had conflicts of interest, that they refused to consider information about chronic Lyme disease, and they refused to appoint any panelists who had an inkling that chronic Lyme disease might exist. So for all of these reasons, the Attorney General sued the Infectious Disease Society of America. In 2008, he actually dropped this case, and the Infectious Disease Society and Blumenthal came to an agreement that they would appoint a new committee that would be vetted by both sides, and that they would review every single recommendation that was in the IDSA guidelines. And they also, as part of this process, invited members of ILADS, the Lyme Literate Physicians, and from various Lyme advocacy groups to present their positions about what chronic Lyme disease was, how you make the diagnosis, and whether prolonged antibiotics was necessary to treat that disease. And the bottom line was 2 years later, in 2010, and $2 million cost to the Infectious Disease Society, it turned out that the panel upheld every single recommendation in the original guidelines. And when they reviewed the data that was presented by the Lyme-literate physicians, they decided that it was not evidence-based and that it should not be included in the guidelines, and that there is no evidence for long-term antibiotic therapy in these patients. There are two common scenarios that we face with respect to Lyme disease. And the first scenario is that of a patient who has documented Lyme disease and after therapy continues to have some nonspecific symptoms. And this occurs in about 10 to 15% of patients with Lyme disease. So you have early manifestations of Lyme disease, and after the 2 to 4 weeks of therapy that's recommended, there still is a certain subset of patients who have, you know, chronic fatigue. They're just not themselves. They have muscle aches and pains. Now, the Lyme-literate physicians would say this is chronic Lyme disease. Give them more antibiotics. And the Infectious Disease Society of America says, no, this is simply a post-Lyme syndrome that doesn't respond to antibiotics. And the reason why they say that is because several studies have been done. And the types of studies that have been done on these patients are like the gold standard of clinical studies. They're prospective, they're randomized, people don't know what treatment they're getting, they're controlled, and they look at the outcomes of the study. And what they did in this particular study was that they took these patients who had Lyme disease, who had treatments, and had some post-Lyme symptoms, and they divided them into two groups. So one group gets a month of intravenous antibiotic, followed by 2 months of oral antibiotics, active against Borrelia. And the other group, the blinded group, they don't know which group they're in, gets a month of intravenous glucose and 2 months of an oral pill that has no activity against Borrelia, a placebo. And at the end of 6 months, when they were evaluated, they were actually evaluated 30, 90, and 180 days. There was absolutely no difference in the symptoms in those patients who got the antibiotics for 3 months or those patients who got placebo for 3 months. Now, I'm not saying that there's not something going on with these patients. There very well may be. I don't know how many of you are fans of Bob Dylan, but I have a favorite Bob Dylan song, which is called The Ballad of a Thin Man. And the refrain of Ballad of a Thin Man is, there's something going on here, Mr. Jones, and you don't know what it is, do you? And that's kind of the way I feel about this particular syndrome. There is probably something going on with these patients who have residual symptoms. I don't particularly know what it is. I don't think it's infection, and I don't think it's something that will respond to antibiotics based on this and several other studies. It may be some immunologic phenomenon that is going on in these patients. The other scenario that occurs is really the most contentious scenario of all, and that is that a patient comes in with these nonspecific symptoms like I described to you, and they have no evidence of exposure to Borrelia. That is, that they do the antibody tests, and they have no evidence of ever having been exposed to Borrelia. Yet they are said to have chronic symptoms that are due to Borrelia. And these are the patients who get treated for months to years of antibiotics. And again, I'm not saying that there's not anything going on with these patients. What I'm saying is that I don't think it's Lyme disease because they don't have antibodies to Borrelia. And I have seen no evidence whatsoever that these patients respond to long-term antibiotics. I just want to share some observations, and I'm going to stop for some questions. And my observations are this, that in infectious diseases, there are really only four spirochetal diseases that we deal with. The first two, relapsing fever and leptospirosis, are very, very uncommon. The other two are syphilis and Lyme disease. If you look at the diagnosis of these diseases, most of the time you can make the diagnosis. Not 100% of the time for relapsing fever and leptospirosis, but somewhere between 55 and 70% of the time. And in syphilis, because of the antibody titers that we can do, we can make the diagnosis in 95 to 100% of patients with syphilis. So it doesn't quite ring true to me why this particular Borrelia infection would be so hard to diagnose serologically like the Lyme-literate physicians maintain. The other observation I would make is that when you look at the duration of therapy of these diseases, for relapsing fever, either depending upon what the cause is, whether it's a louse-borne or a tick-borne disease, single dose of therapy or 10 days of therapy. For leptospirosis, even the most severe cases, duration of therapy is 7 days. For syphilis, it depends on the stage of the disease, but even when there is neurosyphilis, the duration of the disease is only 10 to 14 days. So again, I have to ask, why is Borrelia and Lyme disease so much different than all these other spirochetal diseases that we know about? And the final question that I have is that with all of the patients out there with chronic Lyme disease who are treated by Lyme-literate physicians with mega doses and mega durations of therapy, why have they never done the gold standard of clinical study? That is to give one group of patients antibiotics, another group of patients placebo, and actually measure to see whether antibiotics have any outcome on those patients. I want to end with just a little bit of levity in this topic. Believe it or not, I was looking at the Chronicle yesterday, and the music review was on this musical group, Deer Tick, that performed at Slim's over the weekend. And I'm saying to myself, everybody's getting into the act. Why did these guys call themselves Deer Tick? And I don't know the answer other than the band originated in Rhode Island and there's a lot of Lyme disease in Rhode Island. For all I know, they all had Lyme disease and met at a Lyme-literate physician's office. I don't know. I'm not sure. But anyway, there's a band out there called Deer Tick. And finally, although infections are not supposed to be political, I will tell you that I was struck by this 2004 CDC map of where Lyme disease was most prevalent. And you can see it's most prevalent in New England, it's most prevalent in the upper Midwest, and it's most prevalent on the West Coast. And I saw that map, and then I looked at the Electoral College votes from 2004. And it turns out that Kerry and Edwards carried the Northeast, the Upper Midwest, and the West Coast. So I'm convinced that those little black-legged ticks have it in for the Democrats. So I will stop there, and I will be glad to answer any questions that you have. Yes, so the question is, all of a sudden it's a new disease and it hasn't been here before. I think that, you know, a lot of it has to do with the ecology in the Northeast, about what the forest were like, about clearing the forest, about farmlands, about moving out, letting the forest regrow, and the interaction of people with the forest and with ticks. It maybe it existed before 1909. It existed before 1975 in the United States, but it hadn't been that well documented. So I think a lot of it has to do with wooded areas and interaction of people and clearing of wooded areas and that sort of thing. Yes. So the question is, how effective are antibiotics for the late stages of Lyme disease when they occur months and years later? And it depends on what you're talking about. First of all, I will emphasize to you that if Lyme disease is treated in its early stages, and by that I mean if it's treated when there's erythema migrans or when there's the summer flu or even when there's facial palsy and a meningitis early on, the late manifestations are almost never seen. So we see arthritis, which is the most common manifestation, years after the original tick bite and infection when it's not recognized. And the truth of the matter is that therapy can be tricky. It can be very tricky. The recommendations are that you treat for 4 weeks. Some people actually treat for a little bit longer than that with an oral regimen. And if the disease comes back again, they recommend treating with intravenous antibiotics for 4 weeks, maybe 6 weeks. But there is a subset of patients who have late manifestations like arthritis who actually have chronic arthritis, and it can last for a long period of time. Yes, that's a wonderful point that, you know, these late manifestations, autoimmune arthritis. There have been reports, for instance, of patients who have recurrent arthritis after therapy with antibiotics, where you aspirate the joint fluid and you can actually get some DNA that is from Borrelia in the joint, but you can't culture an organism out. So there is probably an immunologic reaction in the body, that there may be some dead organisms that are present and you get an antigen antibody response and you get an immune complex arthritis. But that may very well be going on, and that may be one of the explanations for these patients who get treated early and have residual symptoms. But again, I would say that prolonged antibiotics is not the therapy for immune complex disease. Yes? The question is, what does the arthritis look like years later? And it's quite variable. Sometimes it's just the lining of the joint, and a single course of antibiotics can take care of it. Sometimes it's more erosive and there's destruction of the lining of the joint, and patients can have chronic problems. And sometimes there's even been description of erosion of bone at the joint. So there's a whole wide spectrum of what it can look like. Yes, so the question is, if you have the test years later, when you develop arthritis, will the antibody test be positive? And the answer to that is yes, it will be, by the conventional teaching. Yes. So that's also a great question. You know, the question is, even though we treat certain infectious diseases, that doesn't mean we eradicate the organism from the body totally. I think that this is one explanation for possibly patients who get treated and have persistent symptoms, that the organism is still there. It's not a live organism. It's a dead organism, but there's an immunologic reaction that may cause ongoing symptoms. Yes. So the first question is, I said that the ELISA test was very sensitive but not specific, that it picks up other things. And what I mean by that is that in your mouth there are spirochetes, spirochetal organisms that are not very pathogenic at all but could possibly cause an antibody response. So you might pick up spirochetes from the mouth that have nothing to do with Borrelia burgdorferi. So the ELISA test is very sensitive. It will pick up not only Borrelia burgdorferi, but also these other spirochetes that may be in your body. And therefore, you have to do a second stage test to confirm that it's due to Borrelia burgdorferi. The question of why is there no good test, and I assume that you're referring to the Lyme literate physicians who say that there's no good test, because in my opinion, it's a circular argument. If you take a group of patients who have nonspecific symptoms and were never exposed to Lyme disease, I wouldn't expect antibodies to be positive. I would expect 90% of them to have negative tests because they've never been exposed to the organism. So it's kind of a circular reasoning when it comes to that. Yes? The question is, can you analyze the spinal fluid and make the diagnosis? Was that your question pretty much? And that gets to be perhaps the trickiest diagnostic dilemma that we have, is trying to make the diagnosis of central nervous system Lyme disease. Again, the organism burden is very, very low. And if you're talking about peripheral manifestations of Lyme disease, where you have numbness, tingling, pain in extremities, you'll never find the organism in the spinal fluid. If you're talking about cognitive dysfunction or a more serious central nervous system function, again, the organism burden is very, very low. And what the way the test is done is they may try to culture it, but usually the test is negative. But they look for antibody titers in the cerebral spinal fluid. And they compare antibody titers in the cerebral spinal fluid to antibody titers in the blood. The idea being that if it's an infection in a closed space, like the central nervous system, antibody titers will be very high. And therefore, the ratio of antibody titers in the central nervous system will be much higher than the antibody titers in the blood. So they do kind of an index to try and pick up whether there is replication of the organism in the central nervous system. But that having been said, I can tell you it's a difficult diagnosis to make. Yes. That's a great question. The analogy being West Nile virus and mosquito populations and controlling the mosquito population. Is there any hope of controlling the tick population? I would have to say that not very practical. Yes. What prompts it to affect the joint space? Great question. I don't know. It just goes there, and it's very common for it to go there. Yes. And the question was, do people ever die from Lyme disease? I at one point had, and I should, in all fairness, tell you about the movie Under Our Skin, which was a documentary that was put on by the International Lyme and Associated Disease Society and multiple advocacy groups. And you can just go, you can Google Under Our Skin, and you can watch the whole movie for free. And they do claim in there that somebody died from Lyme disease. I suppose that it's possible, but in the United States, it's got to be exceedingly, exceedingly rare. And I don't know whether that person died because of all the medication they were taking or because of the Lyme disease. Yes. I see. So, great question. Are there any alternative therapies, like herb therapy, that I support for this? I'm not an herbologist, but I would say, given the situation as it is, and given my beliefs about the lack of effect of antibiotics, I would welcome any alternative therapy that somebody would try instead of antibiotics.
Nothing specific.
I don't know anything specifically. Yes. Great question. If you get Lyme disease once, can you get it again? And this kind of bears on the question of somebody who has Lyme disease and has an exacerbation of symptoms. And they've actually looked at this in the sense of taking people who had erythema migraines and having been treated and subsequently developing another episode of erythema migraines. The question being, is this a failure of antibiotics and a relapse, like people who believe in chronic Lyme disease would like to say, or is this a reinfection? And it turns out that in almost every single one of those cases where they had paired samples from individuals who had recurrent erythema migraines, it was a different DNA type, indicating that they got reinfected with a different strain, and it was not chronic disease. Yes? Yeah, so the question is, why do so few ticks in California have Borrelia burgdorferi in them as opposed to the East Coast? And you're exactly right. Part of the life cycle of the Ixodes pacificus ticks is to feed on cold-blooded animals, and the organism does not propagate in cold-blooded animals, so it's kind of a dead end for the ecological cycle. In cold blood, right. So it's a dead end. Have the cases declined? No. As a matter of fact, as I recall, the CDC said that there are probably 10 times more cases than are even reported. So it's common. It happens. Yes. So the question is, if you did get the vaccine when it was available, how long does the immunity last? And I don't think anybody knows the answer to that, because it wasn't on the market long enough to be able to follow to see how frequently you needed a booster dose of that. So I don't know the answer to that. You want to know, I guess, the reasoning behind the Lyme-literate physicians' approach to this disease. I guess they're just believers. It's hard for me to understand it, too. But there is a huge population of individuals who are out there who truly believe that they are doing the right thing, and they believe that this is the answer. And I can't tell you the thought process. I've had multiple interactions with them. One of my favorite interactions was when one of the Lyme-literate physicians and I were on opposite sides of a court case dealing with a young child who I thought did not have Lyme disease but had another inflammatory disease, had ulcerative colitis, and he was saying, no, it's Lyme disease. And I explained all of this to the judge about the IDSA getting sued, about the new panel, about the review of all the data, about the fact that actually this person that was on the other side of the case actually presented the data to this panel. And his comment was to the judge, "Judge, I know Dr. Jacobs very well. He is a great infectious disease physician, but he knows nothing about Lyme disease." So that's the way it goes. Yes. So the question is there an overlap between the symptoms of chronic fatigue syndrome and chronic Lyme disease? And I would have to say absolutely there is an overlap. And, you know, how you make the distinction between one and the other, I guess it depends in part, you know, who you see and what their perspective is about it. Yes. So I guess I'm trying to put this in a clinical context. So if somebody develops an acute arthritis of the knee, would a regular physician have that at the top of their differential diagnosis? I think that, to be honest with you, some would and some wouldn't. I'll be very honest with you. I just, you know, as we just consulted on somebody who had a young person who had a hip infection and had the hip opened and drained, and it looked very much like a septic arthritis due to a staph or a strep or an E. coli or gram-negative organism. All the cultures were negative. And he got treated with antibiotics. And then the more I started thinking about this after he left the hospital, I was saying, you know, this guy's got a pretty big outdoor exposure. He loved to fish. He loved to camp. He loved to go out and do this. And the hip is not the most common joint to be affected. But I said to myself after he was discharged, you know, I think I better get Lyme titers on this guy. And I haven't gotten them yet. He hasn't shown up to get them yet. But, you know, so I think the answer to your question is, you know, it depends on the clinical scenario. It depends on how much talk Lyme disease gets in the area. I think on the East Coast, I think that it would be unlikely that anybody would miss a Lyme arthritis, or very few people would miss Lyme arthritis, because it's just in the forefront out there all of the time. Okay, we will stop here. Thank you very much for your attention.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.